Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader, brought to you by Wellington Square Bookshop. Really excited today because our guest is Carrie Maher, author of The Paris Bookseller, published by Berkeley & Berkeley just a couple of days ago. And you guys all know how much I like James Joyce and Ulysses and Dubliners and Stephen Hero before Portrait of the Artist. So this is great for me. And it's also on a very auspicious occasion because this is exactly pretty much 100 years since Sylvia Beach published Ulysses, and almost on his 40th birthday. And it happens to be the exact day of his death, January 13th in 1941. So it's the 101st anniversary of his death. So Carrie has written this book, The Paris Bookseller, like I said, published by Berkeley & Berkeley. And her first novel is The Kennedy Debutante, which is about Kit Kennedy, another one of the really cool and fun, but tragic members of the Kennedy family, who died in 1948, 4 years after her older brother Joseph died. And the second is The Girl in White Gloves, which is about Grace Kelly, who's a native of Philadelphia, and many people probably know about her in addition to her work, but just from being a son of John Kelly, Kelly for Brickwork here down on the Schuylkill River. And yep. The third is this one, but also under a nom de plume, which is Carrie Majors. She wrote, "This is not a writing manual, and it's notes for the young writer in the real world." And not only is it a great book for YA potential authors, but it also is a good way of learning a lot about Carrie and essentially her own biography. So anyway, with that, welcome, Carrie, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me and for that lovely introduction.
You're welcome. So one of the things that I wanted to not get out of the way, but I want to talk about first is we had chatted a little bit before we started about the way you write, because, you know, like a kind of synopsis of Grace Kelly and Kit Kennedy, and now another one of these celebrities, people that everyone, well, maybe not Sylvia so much, but how do you go about doing it? Because when I interviewed Eric Larson, I kind of got him piqued because I said, you know, is this like, you know, you're making some of this up? And he goes, if it's in quotes, they said it. And he was really upset that I suggested that something he wrote wasn't exactly the way it happened. So how is your technique different than that?
Oh, I would say it's very different than that. I mean, everything that is in quotes is entirely made up. Well, not entirely. I mean, there are a couple of things that I pulled, you know, here and there from the research. But, you know, one of the things I discovered with my first historical novel, The Kennedy Debutante, that you mentioned, is that, you know, quotes are like notoriously slippery. You know, if they're in letters, they're often remembered, or they're from interviews. So again, they're remembered. And so everything is through a prism or a lens of some sort, right? And so, you know, I think, I mean, if you're asking kind of the balance that I try to strike between the real and the fictional, you know, I try to do as much research as I possibly can. You know, these first three novels have been not just historical fiction, but what's sort of also known as biographical fiction. So they're definitely novels, but they are about people who did walk planet Earth with all of us. And so I really do want to do justice to their lives, to the voices that they did have, to the ideas and thoughts that they did have. And so I try to do as much reading as I possibly can to kind of get internalize that. But when it comes time for me to actually do the writing, all of that necessarily kind of has to fade to the sort of the wallpaper in my mind, if you will. And so I can create them as characters that can come alive on the page. And of course, I have to toggle back and forth between my research, you know, the facts sometimes and the scenes that I'm making up. And I always approach the first draft with a big outline of events and ideas that I want to kind of incorporate, some of which actually make their way into scenes and some of which don't. You know, sometimes, you know, ideas that I had when I was researching and outlining don't make it into the book. But that's all just part of the process.
Yeah. And what's good is in the, like I said, the kind of afterword, you explain that process and talk about it. And then you also give a selected bibliography of the books you relied on. And it's funny because I had just interviewed a couple of years ago, The Most Dangerous Book.
Kevin Birmingham, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And it's surprising. It got so many hits. The YouTube video got so many hits because I didn't really think people would still be interested. And they really were. And it was a great book. And we can talk later about Judge Woolsey's opinion, which was so cool. And here I go. I'm going off on my own. Okay. So why don't you tell us in a thumbnail sketch, basically maybe why you chose this subject and then a summary of what it's about, the life of Sylvia Beach. And there's so many amazing authors, Ezra Pound, T.S. Eliot, Scott Fitzgerald, Picasso, Hemingway. It just goes on and on.
I know.
It's amazing. So anyway, why don't you go ahead and tell us instead of me.
Okay. So I'll start with the second part of your question, actually. So it's about Sylvia Beach, the American woman who opened the original Shakespeare and Company bookstore in Paris in 1919, which quickly became the home of those lost generation writers, that you just named, right? Like the art writers and the artists of the 1920s and into the 30s, many of whom were American, who were escaping the forces of censorship and conservative thinking that had really taken root in America in the post-World War I period, who found themselves in Paris making their art. And so Shakespeare and Company was really their home. Like, you know, in some cases, it was even their post office box. You know, if there was a writer who was sort of traveling throughout Europe or France or hadn't really found a permanent address in Paris yet, Sylvia would let them have all their mail sent to Shakespeare and Company. And so, as if that wasn't enough, she also published the very first edition of James Joyce's Ulysses. As you said, we're right on the centennial. Those first editions came rolled off the press on James Joyce's 40th birthday, February 2nd, 1922. And so we're just at the centennial. And she volunteered to publish it after it had become a banned book in 1921 in a big obscenity trial in New York City. And I'm sure we'll talk more about that. So that's what the book is about. Now, how did I come to know about her story? It's actually sort of an interesting one. I've carried her story around with me my entire adult life. More than 20 years ago, I was a young English major at UC Berkeley, and my favorite period was the 1920s. You know, I took all the classes I possibly could that involved Hemingway and Fitzgerald in this whole period. I was particularly entranced by the expatriate movement. I just thought that that was a fascinating moment in history and literary history. And so, you know, those wonderful dollar bins of books in front of, you know, college bookstores. So I was, you know, looking through one of those one day and happened upon a used copy of Sylvia Beach's own memoir, which she called Shakespeare and Company. And I read the back and it said Paris in the 20s, and I was sold. I took it home and I read it, and I just absolutely was enthralled by her story, like this amazing thing that she did, opening this bookstore where an Ernest Hemingway was like a lifelong friend of hers. And then she published James Joyce's Ulysses. So, but you know, I was 20 years old. I kind of filed it away in my mind under good to know. And you fast forward a good number of years, and I've written about Kit Kennedy and Grace Kelly. And I was thinking about what would make another good subject. And I very quickly homed in on Sylvia Beach. And it's sort of amazing to me that it took me so long to figure this out, like, especially because I have known her story for so long. But really, you know, in the end, in the scheme of things, it's really, I'm glad that it took me so long. I think I needed to write two other historical novels before I was prepared to kind of put words in the mouth of Hemingway and Joyce and Sylvia herself. So that's how I came to write The Paris Bookseller.
Do you think that, like, I've always thought about this, you know, the expression, does a man make the times or do times make the man? Mm. It's like the Beatles. Did this all just come together because she was there, or, you know, the opposite? And it's just like, did she essentially cause this or create a critical mass, or would it have happened without her being present?
You know, it's hard for me to imagine. I think that Paris in the 20s would have happened whether Shakespeare and Company was an address or not. But I think that the fact that Shakespeare and Company offered an address, a place where people could go and talk and read books and exchange ideas about books. And those conversations would spill out onto, you know, the very famous cafes like the Dome and the Dumego. And, you know, that happened. It did happen because Shakespeare and Company was a home, but I think that the movement would have happened anyway. You know, I think one of my favorite characters, minor characters in the book was Ezra Pound, who, you know, he winds up really on the wrong side of history in World War II. But, you know, in 1920, he was a young poet. He was also an editor and kind of a consultant on many other of these avant-garde literary journals at the time. And he really believed in the writing he was doing and the writing Joyce and these other what we now call modernist writers were doing, that they were part of something new and important, right? And so he settles in Paris and starts writing to T.S. Eliot and James Joyce and many others saying, hey, Paris is where it's at. Come to Paris. And he, you know, goes into Shakespeare and Company one day and helps fix some of the furniture in there. I just love the fact that he's a carpenter as well as this sort of a tastemaker and he's a putter together of people and things, right? Wood as well as relationships. I just love that about him. And so, you know, Ezra Pound was doing that work irrespective of Shakespeare and Company as an address, but certainly the fact that Shakespeare and Company, I've said this, I think, three times already. I'll say it one last time and then we'll go to the next question. It helped to provide a home to this.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. You know, one of my favorite scenes in the book is when she's in dire straits monetarily and they have the big reading.
Yes.
Essentially a salon with all the people present. And, you know, she's shy about speaking, but when T.S. Eliot gets up and begins to read Prufrock?
Wasteland.
Yeah. Wasteland. And he does the dedication and Ezra Pound responds from the audience. And it's just like, wow, you know, whatever you may be doing, this really did happen. You know,
it did happen.
Just like the part about Hemingway reopening it, expatriating it after the war. Which you like that story. I like that story too.
People who know Shakespeare and Company all know that story. Like that Hemingway liberates Shakespeare and Company after the liberation of Paris. It's just such a joyful, exuberant moment.
Yeah. And the other thing is about, and here I go, is about, you know, like the new Shakespeare and Company and the new Sylvia Beach and you, because I've been there doing exactly what you were doing, sitting outside, yes. Reading and writing, having a cup of coffee, and going inside and being amazed and then thinking about that shop, which is amazing. And then thinking what hers must have been like. Oh, talk about the lending library aspect of it.
Yeah. Well, so actually can we just spend a minute talking about the current Shakespeare and Company? Because for listeners who don't know, the current Shakespeare and Company in Paris has been open in that location, which faces Notre Dame Cathedral, okay? It's like in the most magical spot in all of Paris. That it has been in that location since 1951. It was never owned by Sylvia Beach. It was opened by another entrepreneurial American named George Whitman. And it was originally called Le Mistral. And it has a wonderful history of its own that I you know, you can go online and look it up. But it's also, he changed the name to Shakespeare and Company in 1964 on the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's birth. And also, it's definitely like a tribute to Sylvia's original store. And Sylvia was herself actually a patron of the store. She was a regular. She used to buy books at Le Mistral. Anyway, so I think that's important for listeners to know, because I think even I was unclear on the relationship between the current Shakespeare and Company bookstore and the original. Let's talk now a little bit more about the original, which unlike the current location, which is entirely a store, Sylvia's Shakespeare and Company was actually as much library, if not more library, than shop. Because, you know, most of these writers in the early days had no money to spend on books, but they did have enough money to pay the modest fee for a subscription to Sylvia's library. And then they could check out as many books as they wanted over the course of a year. And actually something that's really terrific that I love to talk about this is Princeton University has a fantastic project called the Shakespeare and Company Project that has digitized all of Sylvia's library cards. So you can go to the Shakespeare and Company Project and look up you know, what did Ernest Hemingway read in 1926? And it will list everything. And they have photographed the actual library cards that Sylvia or one of her assistants hand wrote out, you know, Ernest Hemingway and what they checked out, he checked out on any particular month of any particular year. So you can actually see it. It's just an amazing tool.
Yeah, I know. I've sent links to that site to so many people and they all write back and they go pretty much the same. This is so cool.
Yes.
And especially when you look at the cards and you see the prices and you see the way they write Ernest Hemingway's name at the top and Miss Gertrude Stein.
Yes.
Yeah, it is amazing. And talk a little bit about the interesting relationship that Sylvia had with Gertrude's, we could go off on all kinds of things, with Gertrude Stein and her relationship, her feelings towards Joyce and what she did with her library card.
Oh yeah. So Gertrude, I loved getting to write, you know, Gertrude. She was also really kind of an intimidating person to try and write about, right? Like, but she had a kind of an innate resistance to Joyce's appearance on the Paris scene. And, you know, I'll let readers, you know, read the novel and decide for themselves. I think that there was some complicated, you know, stuff going on there. There was a little bit of like rivalry and jealousy and things going on there. But she really did not take well to Sylvia offering to publish Ulysses. So she comes down one day and pulls her subscription to Shakespeare and Company and says, I'm going to go to the American Library in Paris. It was new. So that was during the two decades that Sylvia was open. The American Library, which still exists in Paris in a different location, was her only competitor. So Gertrude sort of in a huff decides to pull her card, but she comes back because how could she not, really? And, you know, in the background there, this is not the focus of my novel at all, but I think people who know this time period certainly know that Gertrude Stein took the young Ernest Hemingway very much under her wing, and she was a real mentor to him artistically, but then they had this enormous falling out. And, you know, so Sylvia was able to sort of view all these things from the sidelines in an interesting way that enabled me to kind of write about it in a way that I think hasn't really been done before, right? Like, I think Hemingway has been a character of a lot of historical fiction in the last 20 years, and some of it has been my absolute favorite. Like, The Paris Wife is just one of my hands down absolute forever favorites. But I got to write about Hemingway from a really different kind of perspective, which is just from like the perspective of a woman who was his friend, and there was never any romantic entanglement.
Yeah, I know. It's like looking at him from your point of view and Sylvia's as a young kid just starting out, being jealous of Scott Fitzgerald and all those kinds of things that you read about and are really well done in your book. But thinking about Gertrude Stein reminds me of how the love stories that are in your book that are separate from what we're talking about now. So you could talk a little bit about the sexuality of women in that time in Paris, because a good portion of the book deals lovingly with the love that those women shared with each other.
Yeah. So Sylvia was romantically involved with a French woman named Adrienne Monnier. And, you know, Adrienne was more than just a romantic partner to Sylvia. She was really her inspiration for Shakespeare and Company. So in 1917, Sylvia finds herself in Paris. She's living with her sister, Cyprian, who's an actress. And Sylvia's a little bit at loose ends. She's sort of like pecking away at some writing, volunteering intermittently with the Red Cross and in the final years of the war. And she, as part of her research, writing an article about the plight of women in Spain, she goes to a little bookstore on the left bank owned by Adrienne Monnier. And she absolutely, and Adrienne's store is also a hybrid bookstore and library. And she absolutely falls in love with the store. The store hosts readings. It is the hub of French bohemian intellectual life. And that's where Sylvia learns that these French intellectual writers, you know, André Gide, Jean Cocteau, like many, you know, a lot of Valerie Larbeau, Paul Valéry, a lot of names that we know, that they read in English and they were hungry to read more books in the original English language, but that those books were really hard to come by in Paris at this time. And so Sylvia originally thought of Shakespeare and Company really as fulfilling this need in the French intellectual community, which it did do, but very quickly it became, as we've already talked about, this home of the American and British expatriates during the period.
It's interesting with regard to Adrian and Sylvia that you painted their love story as one that came on gradually and the longing that Sylvia had for her. Now, I assume that's generally what you thought, but maybe there is some grounding for that as well. But it was really well done and does describe a certain type of relationship and how they begin, whether it's a guy and a girl or a guy and a guy.
Yeah, I think that's right. And so I lost track of your original question there. I got so excited talking about Shakespeare and Company again. So yeah, I mean, it was interesting for me to learn about the sort of the realistic way in which Sylvia's and Adrienne's romantic relationship would have worked and been received at this moment in history and in this time and place, right? And, you know, I think famously, Gertrude Stein and Alice Toklas were living together effectively as a married couple in Paris, and that was just an accepted thing. Again, this is a bohemian section of Paris, right? And so, but I think one of the things that was really important that I discovered in my research is that same-sex relations were decriminalized at the time of the French Revolution. And so Paris really was for many, many years a safe haven for same-sex couples. You know, it's still 100 years ago. And so the social and moral rules at the time were more conservative for everybody, straight, gay, you know, queer, you know, whatever. But they same-sex couples didn't have the same things to fear in Paris that they would have in Berlin or Chicago or New York, where in the 1920s, gay bars and cabarets were all the rage. It was just that they were illegal in those places.
Yeah, and it's funny because, you know, there were these great clubs that they went to, and there's so many relationships in the book. And then, not to be a spoiler, but what happened later on with regard to the relationship between Adrian and but that's beyond the scope of
your book. But I will say this: the real foundation of Sylvia and Adrian's relationship was a deep, deep friendship, rooted in a mutual love of literature and Paris and their careers, right? So I think that is really, that provided some very solid ground for the two of them to have a lifelong relationship, even beyond their romance, I'll say that.
I would have had a relationship with her just for her cooking.
Adrienne, I know, right? She was well known as a very good cook. She was a total gourmet. And so that was a fun thing to get to write about in the book.
Yeah, and it's funny because you talk about your Instagram feed and how much you love food and recipes. And from time to time, you may post them. So I think you probably had a good time describing the meals that she made.
Yes, and I had a good time eating when I was in Paris.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, my favorite thing in Paris is just to walk around with a baguette and cheese. And it's like, why is it so delicious? It doesn't make any sense.
I know. We have, because the truth is, we actually have great baguette and cheese and even great pastry in America now. But there is just something different about it when you're in France. It just is.
Yeah. Well, let's get to Joyce. And, one thing before prefacing that is that in the book, the conversations between Joyce and Sylvia and even Joyce and Hemingway are so informal. And I was always thinking of Joyce as being this really tight, you know, person that wasn't really inclined to have conversations at all with anyone and very arrogant. And, you know, the one thing he said was, "I only ask one thing of the reader, that they spend the rest of their life diagnosing and analyzing my work," you know, that kind of person. So do you think they actually did have, like, you know, the way they joked and the cat and all that kind of stuff?
Yes. Well, so I think that the great thing about Joyce as a subject and as a character is that both things are true. He did have this kind of arch side to him, this kind of a little bit of an arrogant side to him, but he also, This really was sort of a surprise and wonderful in my research, that he did have this playful side as well. He and Sylvia used to play word games in the store. And you know, something that I have in the book, maybe even once or even twice, is this game that they played. They really did play, where they would stand in the entryway to Shakespeare and Company, or sit at a cafe in the neighborhood, and they would look at the passersby and scan them for Leopold Blooms or Molly Blooms or Stevens. And so, and they would say, and they would talk about, you know, whether or not that was a Steven or that was a Molly. And, you know, those are the kinds of details that you discover in your research that really bring these people to life, at least for me. Right. You know, it was like finding out that Ezra Pound liked to fix and build furniture. That just put him into relief for me. And as did these kind of games, these sort of playful games that Sylvia and he and Sylvia would play together.
Yeah. A person like Ezra Pound, if you own a bookshop like I do, is a really good person to have around. I had a really good friend, Rich, he's no longer with us, but he would just come in if he saw something. It's like me with pictures. If I go to a doctor's office and the pictures are hanging slightly crooked, drives me crazy and I have to straighten him out. And that's how he was as Ezra Pound with furniture. He had to fix it. It was a compulsion.
Yep. Some people are just like that.
Yeah. And it's interesting that she and Joyce, the manner in which she became his champion. And talk a little bit about that. And then we can talk about the book itself and why it's such an important book and why it went through this really difficult course. But talk a little bit about how she became, it took an incredible amount of courage, and that's what people don't understand, but that they don't understand that. I don't think.
Well, so I'm going to back up a little bit. So as she is opening Shakespeare and Company in 1919, and her first customers are coming to the store, and Joyce comes to Paris in 1920. And, you know, as that is all happening in Paris, in New York, Ulysses is being serialized by this journal called The Little Review, which is published and edited by two women named Margaret Anderson and Jane Heap. And the New York Society for the Suppression of Vice, otherwise known as the Vice Squad, led by John Sumner, has sort of cottoned on to the fact that The Little Review publishes some pretty daring things, especially chapters from this Irish writer named James Joyce from this new novel called Ulysses. And there is widespread suspicion that this is an obscene, you know, obscene in quotation marks, book, that this it contains obscene material. And of course, what Margaret Anderson and Jane Heap and all the astute readers of the time understand is that it's daring art, right? But because it is so honest and bold in its representation of the body and the mind, it is mistaken by John Sumner and his vice squad as smut. And so when copies of The Little Review get mailed to subscribers, the post office is entreated by the vice squad to seize these copies and burn them. And so all of this is happening, and it all comes to a head in 1921 when the Circe episode that is serialized in The Little Review is seized by John Sumner, and it finally Jane Heap and Margaret Anderson are arrested and have to stand trial for publishing potentially obscene material. And so, and all of this, the news of this is slowly reaching the Paris expat community. And so Sylvia and her friends are, including James Joyce, are watching this from the sideline with bated breath. And what happens is, in fact, Margaret and Jane are convicted of publishing obscene material, and all offers in New York and London to publish Ulysses are withdrawn. And Sylvia is appalled by this because she loves the book and really believes that the book is going to change the world. It's going to change literature. So she offers to publish it from Shakespeare and Company in Paris. And James Joyce says yes. And then the challenge, of course, becomes smuggling the book back into the United States, as I like to say, alongside the illegal hooch, because, you know, it was prohibition. So that's a fun piece of the story too. So, but I think you wanted to, I think, segue into talking more about the book and its importance.
Yeah. And when I was, while you were talking, I was thinking, first of all, talk about the painting behind you.
Oh yes. Cause people will get to see it. So this is the painting on which the book cover is based. I feel so lucky I was able to get my hands on this painting. So my publisher, Berkeley, commissioned this painter named Terry Mura, he lives out in Los Angeles, to do this painting that they knew that they were going to base the cover on. And there was a whole period where we were exchanging sketches. And I actually asked to have Teddy, the little shop dog, added to the, and I'm so glad. Teddy actually plays an important part in the novel. So, and he was a real dog. She really did have a dog. And in fact, James Joyce hated dogs. He was afraid of them. That's also true. So that was another sort of fun, true piece of the character that I got to play with in the novel. So yeah, so I just feel so lucky, and I love being able to show people the actual painting. It's really hard to see like on a screen, but it's beautiful. I mean, the brush strokes and the way he handled the paint and everything is just gorgeous.
Okay. Well then, given that, let's talk about the book itself, how she went about publishing, the printer, who was a really nice guy.
Yes.
And then how the 1,000 copies, the Vers d'Arge, the 750. Talk a little about that whole process and then I can show off.
Yes. Okay. Well, so she employed this French printer who was based in Dijon, named Maurice Durantier. And he agreed, she told him it was illegal and the book had been banned. And he was like, I don't care. So it was this incredible process where Joyce had not finished the book. And so he is simultaneously trying to finish writing Ulysses as Sylvia and no fewer than 12 typists are trying to reconcile all the various different versions of the earlier chapters that existed so that they can send them to the printer in Dijon for typesetting. And then even once the printer set the type and printed page proofs and sent them back to Sylvia and Joyce for basically approval, Joyce would then take those pages and like make like wild revisions, like giant X'd out sections and you know, revisions in the margin. Someone tallied up once that, you know, a third of the final version of Ulysses was written on the page proofs. Okay. So, and just as a measure now, it's actually part of your contract that once you're at the page proof stage, you're only allowed to change up to 10% of the book, or you, the writer, will have to pay to reset the type. So I like to think of that as like the James Joyce clause.
Yeah. And the thing about, in addition to the, you can't read his writing. It's impossible.
No. So there's lots of, yeah. Oh, so you get to, this is an amazing show and tell. I got a little sneak peek of this before we.
Well, this is live. I mean, this is how he wrote. There's no way I couldn't and I wouldn't do it. It's too much work, and I don't like to do work. But I mean, look at this.
I know, impossible, right?
It's impossible to decipher. I don't know. And then, of course, Sylvia does give the caveat at the beginning of her published book that says, you know, hey, this might not be right, but given the circumstances. I don't know what she means exactly. What does she mean?
Well, I think she means that she did the best she could. I mean, yeah. In her own memoir, by her own admission, she's like, I don't think that anyone should go about publishing the way I did. You know, she went into it. It was a passion project for her. She, you know, she didn't publish anyone or anything else. I mean, she did publish some other smaller works by James Joyce, and she was originally going to publish Finnegan's Wake, but that didn't wind up happening. Anyway, so really, she was really publishing Ulysses because she really believed in Ulysses.
So you talk so much about the book and the way it was made, you know, and even now, so this is the clamshell case and not the clamshell, a slipcase. And this is beautifully bound by the Chelsea bindery. And this is the picture when I bought the book, this came and this was taken by, who was this taken by?
Well, you said, I didn't realize it was taken by, I thought this was earlier than Giselle coming on the scene.
Well, maybe it is. It's 22. It's 1922.
So I think it's earlier than Giselle.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
I don't know who took it then. But anyway, so this is the first edition, first printing of Ulysses. And people don't understand, but the sea green wrappers are so important because there was only 750. And in order to get in the United States, most people ripped the wrappers off. So there's very few which have the original wrappers. And then
And it's blue because Joyce was really wanted it, even though it all takes place in Dublin, he wanted it to be the blue of the Greek flag. And so there was a whole like caper associated with finding the right blue dye for the cover.
Yeah, it is striking. And the construction of the book, and here's the frontispiece, date. And the thing is, like you talk about the edges of the book and the cutting, And even now, I mean, if you look at it, it's beautifully set. And yes, you seldom, even today, find a book that's so well done. I don't even know how it could have been done. And it's just that, and then she went on to, well, okay, here I'm going to go. I don't want to go off again. Talk about, okay, so she did all this work. She treated him well. She loaned him money. She forgave his debts. She continued to do all she could for him. So go on to the next stage where I wouldn't call it a betrayal. And then you have a resolution of the betrayal as well. Oh,
yes. Well, I'm just going to insert here that spoilers are about to happen. Although, you know, when we write historical fiction, though, we know that readers know the whole story. Readers know the whole story, right? And so a lot of the pleasure is in the journey. So I just want to remind everyone that really what Sylvia's heart and soul was behind Ulysses as a book, that was a world-changing kind of book. So anyway, long story short, she publishes multiple editions of Ulysses through the 1920s. The book starts getting pirated. Do you want to show you? Okay, yeah. So the book is pirated in New York by a man named Samuel Roth. First, he publishes illegally. He serializes it in his journal called Two Worlds Journal. And then he also assembles all the chapters and publishes it in a cheap edition. There we go. Yeah. True Worlds Monthly, edited by Samuel Roth. So this is a pirate. This is the unapproved pirated version of Ulysses, but he sold it cheaply. You know, Sylvia's Ulysses couldn't be cheap because, first of all, it was being printed in Paris. In the first printing, she and Joyce decided to do a tiered print. They had a special very first edition of 150, only 150 copies of Verge d'Arche's paper. It's a very fine, thick paper that were signed by Joyce. Then there were another 200, or I guess another, I think it was 250. I forgot to reconsult my numbers before the podcast, that were on very nice paper. And then there was sort of like the less expensive, but still very nice version. But then, you know, someone who bought Ulysses from Shakespeare and Company wasn't just buying just the book. They were also paying for it to be brought, like I said earlier, smuggled and sent back into the United States in most cases, unless they could happen to be able to be in Paris to buy themselves a copy. So it was really a big deal that Samuel Roth was printing these cheap editions that he sold in New York. And so what was happening through the 20s and into the 30s was that even though it was a banned book, it sort of just became an accepted banned book. Like it would come through customs and no one would care anymore. But Joyce and Sylvia were losing money as Samuel Roth was selling tens of thousands of copies of his cheap edition. That was all money that they were not seeing. And so Joyce really tried to stop the piracy. There was a whole campaign to stop the piracy, but it didn't work. And so in the end, Joyce really felt like the only way, and Sylvia too, actually, felt like the only way to really stop the piracy and make sure that money went to the right people was for an American publisher to actually publish the book. And there were, by the mid-30s, offers by American publishers to publish the book. But in order to publish the book, they had to force the book back through the legal system to effectively unban it. And Sylvia had a real stake in that game. You know, she had spent more than a decade of her life devoted to this book and to its writer. And so the thought of losing the book as an income stream, and she really felt not just losing the income stream from purchases of the book itself, but Ulysses had kind of put Shakespeare and Company on the map. It brought more people into the store. So she was really concerned that if Shakespeare and Company no longer was the publisher of Ulysses, that she might, that the bookstore might wither on the vine as well. So it was a high stakes negotiation when the American publishers came back around to try and publish the book en masse.
Going forward for me, which was one of the best parts, and I've always thought of, you portray him in the book, matter-of-factly, and you quote his letter to Sylvia, is Bennett Cerf. I always thought of him, you know Bennett Cerf from What's My Line or whatever show he was on.
I know, right, yeah. I did that. That is actually a fictionalized letter.
Okay.
There were letters exchanged, but I did fictionalize the letter.
Yeah. So the point is, he was trying to buy out, and Sylvia wanted to sell out her rights, and she was asking for a certain amount. He didn't want to give it to her. And then he took it, as you said, he almost forced them to seize it. So he took it through the legal system. And eventually, you talk about Learned Hand. When I was in law school, I thought he was the greatest judge, Learned and Augustus Hand. But the best part to me is the fact that Judge Woolsey's opinion, which couldn't be written today, and like, say, a Trump appointee. Can you imagine a Trump appointee writing an opinion like that, or even caring or understanding? And it's one of the best written opinions I've ever read. And then the Bennett Cerf included the opinion in his actual
Right. Yeah. And I think that most editions of Ulysses today also include his opinion. And I can't actually imagine Barack Obama writing such an opinion.
Yeah, me too.
Or someone that he appointed. But yeah, it's really, I mean, it, like, Woolsey's opinion almost became part of the story and part of the canon of banned literature. And he really saw what Joyce was trying to do. But of course, he had the benefit of 15 years of hindsight. Sylvia just believed that all of that was true from the get-go, right, in 1921 and 22. And so, like, I really, when I say that she's a visionary, she really was, because she saw that everything that Woolsey said was true from the get-go.
Yeah, and she saw it in so many other authors too. And right. Gertrude Stein saw it also in authors and in painters. And you wonder, okay, did they become popular because they, or did they just have this prescience that they knew that this was something that was going to change the world? And as you said in the book, you know, she knew in the 1970s, the 1980s, the 1990s, that this would still be something that people would be interested in. Here we are in 2022, and it's exactly the same.
Right. We're excited about celebrating these 100 years. I mean, yes, 100%.
Or like Bloomsday.
Bloomsday, a term that she coined, I think, which really has gotten lost, I think, to in the celebrations of Ulysses. I mean, because, you know, it is an amazing work of art, separate from whoever published it, right? Yeah, she did. She coined the term in the 20s when they were celebrating Bloomsday in Paris.
Yeah, I remember that. I was an English literature major, and I remember choosing this course, the honor seminar in James Joyce Ulysses. I didn't even know what I was choosing. And I was just like, holy shit. You know, it's like,
even, what have even, I done?
Yeah. And then in the beginning, Plumpley State, Buck Mulligan. And that, I thought about your book too, because in my mind, I have this Plumpley State, Buck Mulligan. And from time to time, I see somebody and I go, God, if they ever made a movie, he's perfect, you know? So I do the same thing. And Molly, especially in the book. Oh, talk about Nora Barnacle.
Oh, so yeah, Nora, who is James Joyce's common-law wife for most of their relationship, although they do make it official in the 30s. So she's a character in the book. She's not a huge character. If you are interested in Nora and her life and her voice, there's a wonderful novel called Nora by an Irish writer named Nuala O'Connor that came out last year that's really terrific that I read. Yeah, I mean, she was Joyce's great pillar in many ways.
Yeah, she was just like, she was just like a regular woman. She was like she could have been married to a fishmonger.
Yeah.
And I remember someone asked her, why don't you read any other books besides, you know, working with your husbands? And she goes, why would I read something when I'm married to the best writer in the world? She was just like a regular woman. She had no literary expertise. And
No.
I'll briefly touch upon, it's interesting that you brought their children into the book, Giacomo.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a scene where Giorgio and Lucia come and get Sylvia because they're really, the family's just in despair about Joyce's eyes that are really, really acting up one day in the summer of 1921. And that's a scene that Sylvia tells in her own memoir very briefly. I think I make my scene is longer, but I thought that was an opportunity for Sylvia to kind of have a window into their family life and how Joyce and Nora functioned as a couple and also as parents and how invested their kids were in their parents. And there's, and I don't make, this is not a huge part of the book, but, you know, Lucia does have her mental illness, and her father, you know, James Joyce is just so devoted to her and loves her so much. And that's a complicated and difficult relationship to explore. And several other actually novels recently have explored it, including Nora. But I just, again, that's sort of like a little bit of a background thing in my novel, but it, all very interesting.
It's amazing to me, like with Sigmund Freud's cancer, that his eyes were so bad and with his hand scratching. And then that one picture of him wearing his glasses plus having the glass to look at the, yeah, and that might've been Giselle's work.
No LASIK surgery.
Yeah. And he had so many surgeries and he had such horrible glaucoma. I don't know how he could have done what he did.
Yeah, I know. I know. It's amazing. The sort of the handicaps that people worked around were kind of amazing.
Yeah, especially back then. Well, I wanted to touch upon one other thing. Oh, yeah, there's so many ways you can come at this book, because even just like, I'm not going to go into it, the prize fighting, the boxing
matches. Oh, yes, yes, the boxing matches. Yes, yes. I know. Yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah, but you bring some, the cool thing about the book is, yes, it's about Sylvia and James, but there are so many other stories in it.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so I think one of the great challenges of writing this book was these two things went hand in hand, right? Like one of the challenges was to know when to stop researching and start writing, because like truly I could have researched the book for the rest of my life and never written a word, right? Because I'm writing about writers who left behind whole lifetimes of bodies of work, and, you know, and they're some of the most studied writers ever, right? So I could have just read endlessly, but I couldn't do that. And then, so then the second challenge became, oh my gosh, there are all these wonderful tidbits and pieces of real historical information. How do I choose? And I had to let it kind of unfold organically. And some things were included in earlier drafts that wound up on the cutting room floor. But yeah, I mean, that whole thing about Ernest Hemingway taking Sylvia and Adrienne to a boxing match and then later teaching Ezra Pound to box, all that stuff is just, it's just, it really shows them as people. I think that's the thing that I really wanted to do most was, you know, here are these amazing literary giants and we revere them so much, but in the end, they're really just people. And I wanted to show that, and not in an irreverent way, but they are human beings.
I know, it's kind of like magical what you did, because they enter the shop and then they just become these regular people that talk and joke and get drunk and do stupid things. It also kind of presages what they became, especially with Hemingway and right. His wife. You only cover a couple of his wives, but yeah, that kind of thing. And I guess to close with, what I would say is, like, I always think about like J.K. Rowling, how whether you like or think Harry Potter is high literature, it's not that important, because what it does is it takes kids who wouldn't have read otherwise, yeah, and it leads them onto Lord of the Rings or whatever they're going to go to. And I think in some ways your book does that, because if you don't know about these things, this is a good way to, oh, it sounds so cool. Or they look at the Shakespeare and Company project and they go, I think I'll read some of these books that this other guy read, you know? And the last thing is that when she talks about how, and I always say this, I even said it in a podcast, how she says, you know, people come in and they might not be looking for a particular book, but then they'll find that book, and that's the book that may change their life. And that's why I think library ladders are cool, because at my bookstore, you climb up on the, I know, I always want, that's why I opened the bookstore.
They're so wonderful.
That's a good reason why I opened it, was I always wanted to have library ladders. Yeah, so I always say, like, if you want a book and you climb the ladder, you see the book, and this is where Amazon can't help you. You see the book, but you also see the book on either side.
Yes, that's right. That's right. I know.
And that's a way of looking at life, and I think a very positive way. So that's what you've done. And all your books do that, because maybe it's not every word that they said, but it's going to invite you to learn more. And that's why it's so good that you included the bibliography as well.
Thank you. That's such a compliment, and thank you so much.
You're welcome. And it was a pleasure talking to you. And this book will be now that I can do it without, you know, it's like, remember those mattress tags that says do not remove under penalty of law?
Yes.
And my brother and I, when we were little, we did it and we thought we were going to get arrested. And that's like when I get the box of your books and it says do not display until whatever date. And I go, well, what if I did, you know?
Yeah. Yes.
Anyway, here I go going on again. So yeah, thank you so much. And like I said, it'll be on the front table.
All right. Well, thank you so much for having me. It was like such a pleasure to talk to you and see your collection. I mean, what an amazing thing. Thank you for showing that.
Yeah, I wish you could come here so I could show off more.
Maybe someday.
Yeah, I would love it.
When the world loosens up a little bit again.
Yeah. Actually, I have COVID right now.
Oh, no. Well, you sound okay.
I had that little bit of a cough. Yeah. Other than that, not that I'm promoting
no.
it.
No, I know.
Yeah. But yeah, no, it's been fine. I'm still obviously isolated here. I want to go to this, you know, I have to go to the store and I can't go to the store.
Yeah, you can't go to the store yet. Yeah, I know. Well, anyway. I hope you are fully recovered very soon. And thank you again for having me.
Likewise. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.